what I'm supposed to tell you is how I came to find God. I mean, that's what it's all about. Now, it's hard to recognize. I was talking to my buddy Mike about this, but I was telling him, you know, one time, for example, and I don't, this is an opinion of mine, just we don't have opinions in Alcoholics Anonymous, but you know, there was a big controversy, and the controversy was between, say, John Dewey and John Henry Newman, right? And John Henry Newman, for example, he wrote something called The Idea of a University. It's a marvelous book. If you ever get it, it's probably the finest piece of English prose ever written. And he made the argument that God has to be in everything, and if you're going to get an education, you have to study about God, and that's a piece of it. And he said, you know, if you leave God out, he said, then who knows, you'll make something else your God. He said, it might even be science. Yeah. And Dewey was saying, you got to leave God out. And I think Dewey's won. And what happens if God, once God leaves my life, is I have no sense of history. You know, I no longer belong. I no longer fit in. I absolutely have got to have God. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done, and what the 12 Steps has done, is put God back in my life. I again have a history. I again belong to something. I again belong. I stand for something. Again, there are principles in my life that I aspire to. I'm no longer some mindless idiot who responds to the environment around me. You know, I'm surrounded by beautiful women. I have friends, I have women friends in Alcoholics Anonymous that are stunningly beautiful. Stunningly beautiful. And I can say to myself, they're stunningly beautiful. And that's it. I no longer have to react to that. I'm married to a woman who's stunningly beautiful. I can't wait to get home and see her. But I don't violate the principles associated with marriage anymore. I don't do that. I don't do that because I'm a good guy. I do that because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I don't stand for that, what do I stand for? I don't use bad language at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did one time, I did a couple times, and a woman loved me enough to come up to me, a very elegant lady, and she said, "Sir, may I ask you a personal question?" I said, "But of course." She said, "Do you eat with the same mouth you talk with?" And I said, "It's pretty offensive, huh?" She said, "Yes, it is, and I don't believe you need to do that." If I'm still doing that, then I haven't learned anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not changing. If I'm the same guy next year I am this year, I'm not doing it right. That's what this whole thing is about. It's all about. Now, the result of that is I like myself better and all that. That's all, you know, joy and all that stuff. It's nice. That isn't why I do it. I do it because it's the next thing to do. It's the way God would have me do it. And, you know, unless I understand the degree to which my character defects or sins, if you will, drive me, okay, how they cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, how they cut me off from the fellowship with God as I understand them, until I understand that, until I beg him to take them away, on my knees, as it says in the manuscript, then I don't understand the degree to which I owe an amends to the people in my life. I don't owe them an amends because of what I did when I was around them, to them. I owe them an amends for what I was when I was around them. I was a self-absorbed, self-centered, selfish human being. And that causes great damage to whomever I come into contact. That's why I owe them an amends. And so when I sat down to make out that 8-step list, I did it with prayer. I did it with, who have I hurt with this selfishness, self-absorption, self-centeredness? The guy who's got to be the center of attention, has got to be the center of the universe, has got to be the center of all the conversations, who I had to remind constantly how wonderful I was, or how brilliant I was, or how successful I was. Yeah. What have I done? You know, I had to go make amends to my brother Denny because he looked so good to me that I detracted from him every chance I got. And I had to, this father never told me he loved me. I had to put him on that list. And the church that I'd grown up in, which I'd grown to blame for everything. I blamed the nuns. The nuns have been blamed for more stuff than the Nazis. You know? I had to put them on the list. And I put God on the list. But just about everything I came into contact with, as a result of my character defects, I did damage to. They were on the list, and I made that list. And, you know, it's interesting. It was such a frightful thing to me to do that I really delayed making the list. And finally, my sponsor said to me, "Keith, where are you on the eighth step?" And I said, "Well, I'm asking for the ability to forgive." He said, "Make the list." So, well, as soon as he said, "Make the list." And so I sat down and I made the list. And he gave me a yellow pad and a number two pencil. And he wrote, "List. List." Right. And of course, most of the names came from my fourth and fifth step. But I made that list. And then I truly, I'll tell you what I did, okay? This isn't in a book, but I took 3 or 5 cards. And everybody on my list, every organization, every institution on my eight-step list, I gave them a card, their own card. And what I'd do in the morning is, when I'd pray in the morning, and I'd start my day by reading page 86, 87, 88, starting in the second paragraph, upon awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. That's how I start my day. I'd think about the 24 hours ahead, I'd write down my plans for the day and that sort of thing. And then I would go through these cards, and I'd pray for the ability to forgive anything they had done to me. Or, you know, to forgive anything. If I anything against them at all. Because this isn't about what they did to me. This is about what I did. And I began to pray for the ability to forgive them. And things would pop into my head and I'd jot them down. And I would frequently, and then I'd sit down with my sponsor. With very few exceptions, I never did a ninth step that I didn't talk to my sponsor about it first. Sometimes God will drop something right in front of you. And it's time to do it. But by and large, I could plan the amends sufficiently, and I could spend time talking to my sponsor about it, and he could help me realize whether or not I had truly forgiven them, or if I was going to use this to gig them, or, you know, whatever, to manipulate them or jerk them around or whatever. He helped me come to that. But then I was able to begin the marvelous task of going to people and making direct amends wherever possible. And oftentimes I would have figured out why I owed them amends. But, you know, oftentimes I was wrong. I told you I had a father who never told me he loved me. And so I tried on 3 or 4 occasions to talk to him. I'd drive from Washington, D.C. to Ohio, where they lived. And I'd sit down and we'd get a cup of coffee. And I'd talk to him for 15 minutes. I'd be so angry. I'd get up and drive back to Washington. And finally he said to my mother, he said, "You know, he's a fine boy, but he drives a long way for a cup of coffee." And, you know, no earthly idea what I'm so upset about. And of course, you know, while I was gaining insight, he was raising 11 children. And finally, my dad had never seen the ocean, and I was living in North Carolina, and this was 3 or 4 years later, I was living in North Carolina, and he came down, and he saw the ocean for the first time. And my brother Larry, who's also in the fellowship, was with him, and he reported this. He said, "I had a little beach house down there, and he stood on the deck looking at the ocean, and the waves were crashing and crashing." And he looked, turned to my brother, he said, "Does it just keep doing that?" Larry said, "As often as I've been watching, it does." And I realized, you know, they had never been on a vacation. You know, they raised 11 children. They raised kids who had no place else to go, so they raised kids that weren't even theirs, and they'd never seen anything or done anything. And I said to him, "You know, moving to Alabama," and I said, "I'm worried about the house. Would you keep an eye on it?" And he said, "Yeah, don't you worry about this house, son." And they kept an eye on it for 6 years. They kept an eye on that house. But I loved them there, and I stopped down to see Dad, and he was sitting in a rocking chair smoking a pipe, and he said to me, we're just talking, and I tried to make this amends to him. And he said to me, he said, "You know, son," he said, "remember the first day you went to work?" And I said, "Well, I kind of." And he said, you went to work setting pins in a bowling alley. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Down in Bridgeport." I said, "Yeah, I remember." And he said, "Remember the first day?" And I said, "I don't think so." And he said, "I took you to lunch." And he said, "We went to the Louis hot dog stand." He said, "Do you remember what you had?" I said, "Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog?" And he said, "Of course you did, you loon." He always called me a loon. And he said, "Do you remember what you drank?" And I said, "Probably an orange pop. I always drank orange pop." He said, "Not that day." He said, "That day you drank root beer." He said, "I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer." And he said, "I talked to you about doing a good day's work for a good day's pay, and that you owed your boss respect and your boss owed you respect." He was telling his 12-year-old son about being a man. And he said, "I walked you to the bus stop, and And I had to go to the next town. And I said to you, son, you want me to come with you the first day? And you said to me, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, you got on a bus. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight and you never looked back. He said, from that day on, I never felt I could tell you anything because you paid for your own clothes. He said, you paid for your high school tuition. He said, you're the only child I have who you wouldn't let me help you through college. You put yourself through college. And I said to him, I'm so sorry. I owed him an amends. Not because I worried him, although I did, because I was crazy and insane. I owed him an amends because I didn't allow him to do what he did best, and that was to be a father. You know, a couple of months later, I needed to borrow some money from him. Need just came up. And I borrowed some money from him and paid him back 2 months later. And from that day till this, he tells me he loves me. You know, the eighth step tells me that people treat me the way I make them treat me. They treat me the way I demand that they treat me. My job is to figure that out, why I owe them an amends. My brother Larry is sober now, this month, 7 years. I went to make amends to Larry many years ago. And he said to me, I said, I wasn't around much. And he said, I understood you weren't around much. He said, you know, you grew up and you went away. I understand that. He said, what I don't understand is the way you treated me when you were around. I said, what do you mean? He said, when you were in the Marine Corps, he said, I loved you. And he said, I respected you more than anybody in the world. And he said, one day, he said, you were coming home. And he said, it was a day before you were supposed to come home. And I was sitting out on the porch. And Mom said, Larry, what are you doing out here? And Larry said, I'm waiting for Keith to come home. And she said, well, he's not coming until tomorrow. And he said, well, they might let him go early. So he was there the day before. And he said that when you came home the next day, he said, you got out of that cab. He said, I'll never forget it. And he told me the ribbons I had, and he told me what they stood for. He saw my shooting badges, and he knew what I had to shoot to get those badges. And he said, you took that sea bag, and you picked it up with one hand, and you put it over your shoulder. He said, I knew you were the strongest guy in the world. And he said, I was so excited, I wet my pants. And he said, I was hoping you wouldn't see. And he said, you came by, and you rubbed my head, and you said, how's it going, kid? And he said, and you never spoke to me for the next 2 weeks. He said, I stood behind you when you were eating, and he stood around me. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know I was important to anybody. That's why I had to act so important. And I owed my brother Larry an amends because I wasn't his big brother. But you know, from that day to this, I've been his big brother, drunk or sober, high or not. He'd come to my house flying high with all these brilliant ideas. And I'd just sit and listen. And I'd say, well, you know, pray about it and do what you think is best. I've never not been his brother, his big brother, for 20 years. And it's my privilege. People would say to me when he was drinking and drugging, they'd say, why don't you say something to him? And I said, I do. I tell him I love him. Yeah, I've been to Al-Anon for too many years to know that I can do anything else. I said, I love him and I pray for him. And then one day he got sober. And my brother Terry was on my amends list. And Terry was a guy I couldn't see because Terry didn't get sober. And Terry was that brother who's more brilliant than anybody in the family. He's a mathematical genius. He could do anything. He was a great boxer. He had an impressive amateur and a professional record. He's the toughest guy I ever knew. Truly the toughest guy I ever knew. And the nicest. And Terry, whenever Terry's alcoholism got him, and it was no longer as tough as he used to be, but his head was when he had a few drinks, and he used to get beaten pretty badly in bars, and he didn't have any teeth left or anything, and I was had him on my list, and I never got to make amends to him, and whenever I'd go home, he'd leave. I think it must have been hard to have a sober brother, and my parents were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, and I hoped that my wife had never met Terry, and she met him, and she's a good Al-Anon, so immediately fell in love with him, you know, because he's a drunk. I hadn't seen him in a while. God, he looked rough. And I tried to talk to him, and he kind of stayed away from me. And I kept praying for the right moment to make amends. And during the celebration of the 50th, everybody was there. And even these kids my parents raised came from all over the world. And they brought their children. And my parents had 11 of their own children, and then 20 grandchildren and 20 great-grandchildren. And people from all over the world were there. It was amazing. And Terry wasn't there. And finally, late in the evening, my brother Henry came to me and said, "Terry's here and he's drunk." I said, "Of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic." And he said, "Why is he like, he doesn't need to be here like that?" And I said, "Yes, he does." I said, "You know, he deserves to be here more than any of the rest of us." I said, "I know where he's been. You know where he was too. He was down the street in a bar trying to get enough courage to come there." And I said, "He must love Mom and Dad an awful lot to come here like that." And I made amends to my brother Terry. And it freed my brothers and sisters to bring him in and to treat him like they felt, and that is that they loved him. And they didn't have to lecture him, and they didn't have to act shocked. They didn't have to, and all we had to do was love him, and that's what we did. We brought him in and loved him. And that day I made amends to my brother Terry. And 6 or 8 months later, he came down with lung cancer, and so I went home to see him, and I got an opportunity to spend some time with him, just the two of us alone in the hospital. And we talked the way brothers talk, and he asked me a lot of things like, "Do you really believe there is a God?" And I said, "I know there's a God." And I talked to him about God as I understand him. And I was back to the church in my childhood, and he had a lot of questions about rosaries and scapulars and all the things that mean so much to me. And I just happened to have a couple, and gave them to him, and we talked about things. And I asked him if I could hug him. I so wanted to hug him for such a long time. But you can't hug alcoholics, because alcoholics aren't there even when we're there. And he told me I could hug him, and then he smiled, and he said, "You know," he said, "I didn't leave town." I said, "I know." And I hugged him. He was so frail. This tough guy weighed probably 90 pounds. And I hugged him just for a few seconds. You know, alcoholics can't hug long. But I remembered a theology lesson that I had learned, and that is that there are two kinds of time. And for a guy like me who's always worried about time, there's chronological time, which is linear, and time passes. And then there's, that's called chronos, and then there's something called kairos, and kairos is God's time. And God's time is always now. And now is forever. And that's why the old timers told us that we can't meet God in the past, we can't meet God in the future. We got to meet him now. That's the nature of God as I understand him now. Understand, not understand, understand now, as I meet him now. And so, in God's time, I hug my brother Terry forever. And you know, he died clean and sober and surrounded by people who love him. And that's exactly how I want to die. I had this group of people that I hated on my list called religious people. You know, the book says we have to see where religious people are right. I hated religious people. And I had on there religious people, and I prayed about it. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and I went down to this place that was a retreat center, because I heard there were a few religious people around there, and I knew there were. For years, I'd gone down and done silent retreats, and I didn't talk much to these people, but I knew they were there. My friend Mike and I have been prayer partners for years, and we go on retreats together every quarter. We go on silent retreats, and I'd be silent. Mike can't be silent, but... You know, you silent retreat, Friday evening, you stop talking, and then you don't talk till Sunday afternoon. Somewhere around 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon, you'd hear coming from the woods. Mike would be out there screaming at the top of his lungs. Shit had to come out. But I went down there, and I went looking for a guy, and one of the guys I was thinking about talking to was this young theologian who was pretty hep, and he'd understand that the significance of the spiritual act I was about to perform, and I couldn't find him. But what I did find was an old guy sitting in a rocking chair reading his breviary. And I went in and I talked to him, and he was an old priest, and I began to tell him why I was there, and talked about living on Skid Row and the things I said about people like him and how I wanted to make amends and how I really envied them because I wanted what they had and I was afraid it wasn't available to me. And That's why I hated him. I got about halfway through and he stopped me. He pulled me up out of the chair, put his arms around me, began to hug me and to pat me. And he said, "You know, son," he said, "it's not you who owe me an amends, it's I who you won." And he began to cry. And he said, "I was just this moment talking to my higher power." And he said, "I've been a priest for 50 years. He said, "I have an illness that's going to allow me to go home soon. And I was just asking my higher power, where have I missed it? Where have I not served you?" And he said, "I realize that too often in my priesthood, I didn't do what my higher power told me. He told me to go find the one who was lost. And he said, I was too comfortable hanging around with the people who agreed with me." He said, "I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone." And I came to understand something of the nature of religious people. Religious people are people who want to do what's right. They remind me an awful lot of alcoholic people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They just do the best they can with what they have. And what that means is I can be one of those people. I mean, I can do the best I can with what I have. So I can be just like those people. And again, I found out that the people who said to me that this is a selfish program didn't understand much about the nature of this program. I did a lot of damage in the world. My disease wasn't selfish. I spread it around liberally over 3 or 4 continents, you know. But I got to tell you, recovery isn't selfish either. We can spread recovery around 3 or 4 continents too. If we just live the way we talk, and I try to live the way I watch people like you live. It's no mistake that the 8th and the 9th step, not all the steps have promises, of course, but it's no mistake that the promises on page 83 and 84 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous are so significant. Because if you look at what's happened to us, just since 2 o'clock this afternoon, we've admitted we're powerless over alcohol. We've come to grips with the fact that left or wrong devices will die. We've turned our will and life over to the care of God. We've done a fearless and searching moral inventory. We've shared with God ourselves and another human being. We've come to realize that left to our own devices, we'll repeat our behaviors again. I wasn't the way I was because I drank. I was the way I was because I was spiritually ill. Had I not drank, I would have blown my brains out or done something else. And then I just made a list of people I had harmed, and I'd gone back, and to the best of my ability, I'd undone that. And then there's wonderful promises. We'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. We won't regret the past and wish to shut the door on it. We'll comprehend the word serenity. We'll know peace. You know, all those promises are so important that they've taken 11 of them and split one of them up to make it 12. I mean, that's how important it is, because if it isn't 12, it won't fit in Alcoholics Anonymous. And but seriously, it concerns me that we read these at so many meetings. It concerns me. Because the idea is if I come to meetings, this will happen to me. No. This doesn't happen to me because I come to me. This happens to me because I do the first 9 things that suggested in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, before I'm halfway through, I don't have to finish. But halfway through the 9th step, these things begin to happen to me. But you know, an old guy gave me a promise. It's not in the book. Because I said to him one time, I was really afraid. I've always been afraid. Fear is the thing that's driven me my whole life. Whenever you see me angry, ask me what I'm afraid of, because that's what's driving it. Old timers, I said to me, "Why should I do this stuff? I'll just move. You know? Why don't I just move? And then I don't have to do all this crap." And he said to me, "I'll tell you why." He said, "How would you like to walk around any corner in the world and not be afraid of who you're going to run into?" That's the great promise for me. That I never, ever have to be afraid of who I'm going to run into. And you know, this step, you can take a long time doing this step. And you can get really petty with it if you want to. And it's fun to get petty with this thing. I had a guy named Rich. And Rich was my hero. I was in the 3rd grade, and Rich was in the 3rd grade. Now, Rich was older than me. When I met him, it was the second time around the 3rd grade. And he was one of the big guys, so I idolized him. You know, and Rich would always choose me to be on his team. And one day a new kid moved to town named Bobby, and he picked Bobby instead of me. And I ended up on the wrong team. And I was crushed. And so I had to punish everybody, of course. So the guy who picked me, I punished him by refusing to catch a touchdown pass. Would have won the game. But most of all, my wrath was really reserved for Richard, you know. And I wouldn't talk to him. Just wouldn't talk to him. And one day he came to me after recess. I wasn't playing ball. Refused to talk to him. He came to me and he said, "How you doing?" I said, "What do you care?" And he said, "Well, I was just wondering. You aren't playing ball. I don't play ball. I quit ball." So that's too bad because you're a good ball player. It's too bad. You should have picked me. And he said to me, "Look, I got an extra Twinkie. I never met a kid with an extra Twinkie, but I mean." He was really trying, and he said, "I got an extra Twinkie." I said, "You don't want that?" And he said, "No." I said, "You sure?" He said, "Yes." So I threw it on the ground, stepped on it, and walked away. Now I'm sober, you know. I go back to my 25th high school reunion. The book says as far back as our minds can carry us. It doesn't say the day we started drinking. It says as far back as our minds can carry us. So I got Richard on the eight-step list. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. I was hoping he didn't come. But he comes in. He's one of those guys who looks like he did in high school. You know, don't you hate him, you know? And so I said to him, "Rich," we shook hands and everything. And I said, "You got a minute? I need to talk to you." And he said, "Sure." And I said, "I got to make amends to you." I told him, I said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And went on just a few minutes. And I said, "Look," I said, "one of the things we do is we make amends for the damage and the harms we've done." And he said, "What on earth would you owe me an amends for?" He said, "We were best friends." And he said, "All through grade school and high school." And I said, "Well," I said, "remember when Bobby Harrington moved to town?" And he said, "Yeah, you took my Twinkie and you threw it on the ground and stepped on it." We both started laughing. And he said, "Why would you owe an amends?" I said, "Rich," I said, "I'll tell you why." I said, "That's the way I acted the rest of my life." I said, "Any time I loved someone or cared about someone and they didn't treat me the way I thought they ought to treat me, I took revenge on them. And I always punished them by withholding my caring. That was the one hammer I always had. I withheld my caring. I did it to my first wife. I did it to my children. I did it to everybody in my life who disappointed me or didn't treat me the way I thought that I ought to be treated." So the program says I go back and pull this stuff out by their roots. And those are the roots. Those were the roots. And there are a lot of other things I can bore you with, but I won't. I won't. But just know that ninth step happens, you know, and the rewards begin to take place. And then we become truly free human beings. Truly free human beings. I no longer went to a job with bosses who didn't understand their job descriptions. You know, I had bosses, they didn't understand their job description. You know, platoon sergeants didn't understand their... They thought their job was to say, "Corporal Lewis, take four men and go do that." That wasn't their job. Their job was to make me feel good about myself. To affirm me. And I realized that I left every job I ever had two ways, successful and angry. As a hard-working guy, so I'd be successful, I was angry because they never understood me. They didn't understand their job description. Now, when I have a boss, I just let him boss me. You know, if he likes me, that's fine. If he doesn't like me, that's fine. He's not in charge of affirming me and make me feel good about myself and do all the stuff that Dad never did. That's not his job. You know, and it's a tremendous freedom in every area of my life. But most of all, I'm free to be me. I'm free to be a sponsor, and I'm free to be a husband. I'm free to be a father and a grandfather. And I'm just free. Most of all, I'm free to be the Son of God. And I don't expect myself to be what I'm not anymore. And I try not to present myself as what I'm not anymore. And what I'm given now are three steps that allow me to function in the world. It's precisely what they're designed to do. They're designed to allow me to function in the world. Steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, and step 10 shows me how on a daily basis I can make decisions about how I'm going to live my life. How the way I invest in my life is I invest one day at a time. You know, I always used to look to make a killing. You know, and that isn't how you do it. You don't wait to make a killing. Wait to win the lottery. You know, what you do is you invest one day at a time. And the 10th step is that spiritual exercise that allows me to invest in my life one day at a time. I make plans for the day. I do. I make plans for the day. I sit down and I make plans and I invite God in every bit of it. I have a list of people that I pray for and I ask God's will in their lives. I don't pray that things change. I pray that God does with them what he would do. And then I pray that if God wants to use me in that situation, I want to be available to be used. During the course of the day, I'm allowed to stop anytime I need to. We talk about the principle in the book, the principle, and I love the way Hal M. from Washington, D.C. talks about it. Hal talks about a partnership. He said, God's a senior partner, I'm the junior partner. He said, God's in charge of long-term planning, and he said, my job is day-to-day operations. And any time that I need to, I can stop, and I can get a hold of the senior partner, and I can ask him how what I'm doing today fits in the long-term plan. And that's as well as I've ever heard it said. That's what the whole deal's about. I love studying about and learning about God as I understand him. I love going back to all those books I read as a kid about God and about the church and about religion. I love that. I love those things because when I do them, I feel closer to who I am, what I am, and what God would have me be. But most of all, I feel closer to God. Near the end of the day, since I no longer have to impress me or him anymore, or anybody else for that matter, I sit down and say, Father, how'd we do today? And I take a look. And you know, the way I like to do it is the first paragraph on page 86 where it says, when we retired, might we constructively. That word constructively is very important. It doesn't say destructively. It says we constructively review our day. And it asks me certain questions about fear and self-centeredness. Those aren't bad things. Those are just symptoms of illness. That's all. They're symptoms of spiritual illness. If I have a fever, I'm physically ill. If I'm selfish, self-centered, or afraid, I'm spiritually ill. I say, what's going on that you're afraid? What is it? You know, and then I can pray about it and write about it and I can talk to my sponsor about it. I can ask, you know, is there anything I could have done better today? You know, have I treated people the way I want them, the way I want to be treated? I have a friend who used to say that his prayer is that people treat him tomorrow the way he treated them today. It's his prayer. And those are the questions I ask myself. Not because I want to be holy, because there's no danger of that. It's because I want to be of more service to God and to my fellow man. That's what it's all about. It's really not about getting ahead. It's really not about being successful. There are people who are successful. There are people who are financially successful and they're rewarded and it's important to them. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. Alcoholics Anonymous does not take a position on any of that. Okay? That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is to be spiritually successful. And some people can do it all. Some can't. It doesn't matter. But none of that matters. What matters is that I'm a maximum service to God and to my fellows. If I can do that, I'm successful. And then, you know, we get to that wonderful step of service, the 12th step. It's just magnificent. You know, the great promise of Alcoholics Anonymous, of course, is having had a spiritual awakening. It's not if we have a spiritual awakening. Is having had a spiritual awakening as a solitary, single purpose of the 12 steps. It's not to make me magnificent or acceptable or any rest of it. Have a spiritual awakening. And that's it. That's what's most important to me. If I have that spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, then I can be assured that I'm of service to God and to my fellows. I don't have to worry about being confident or capable or any of the rest of it. Because you don't want me for what I know. You don't want me for the conversation I can carry on. You don't want me for what I can teach you because I can't teach you. You want me for who I am. And that's what I always tried to hide from. I tried to hide that from you. You know, I would walk around and when I was a real little kid, I used to walk around and act like I was rich. My brother, Dumb Denny, said to me one time, I'll never forget this, we're laying in bed together, and Dumb Denny said to me, when I grow up, he said, I'm going to study real hard, and I'm going to work real hard, and I'm going to get rich. I said, you are? He said, yeah. He said, I'm going to get so rich that any time I want to, I'm going to order peasant under glass. Instead of pheasant under glass. And so, you know, for years now, Denny and I will be in a restaurant. And a waiter will come. And Denny will look sick. And the waiter will say, would you care for a drink? And I always say something like, yeah, give me a case of scotch and a fire axe. And Denny, you know, just drink it. And then he'll say, what would you like to eat? And I said, how's your peasant under glass? And then he'll crawl under the table. You know? You know, the thrill. I was sober about, I'm all lost on time, I apologize. I have no idea what the fire alarms and everything else was going on. But then I didn't have any idea what was going on before I got here, so, but we don't care. I won't take much more of your time, I promise. But, you know, I was sober about 12 or 13 years. And I think 12 or 13 years is often a critical time in sobriety. And I had been successful. I was a vice president of a hospital corporation. I'd been running all over the country buying and selling and building and just doing all kinds of things. And staying active in Alcoholics Anonymous, always active, but no real center. You know, no real center. And what I had, and now when I was in town, I would pick up a few people from the halfway house and take them to meetings and this and that. I somehow knew on some level that the new man was the basis of my existence, or there was no existence. But I had gotten awfully doggone important. And I had gone back up to North Carolina and we bought a building. And I was jumping in and out of relationships. And I was over 40 years of age and I still didn't know. I couldn't attach morality in my life when it came to sex and things like that. And I was just fed up. I just ended another one of those relationships, you know, where we used one another and you know, totally unfulfilling. And more than unfulfilling, was destructive. And I got on my knees one night. I was at my friend Bob Brown's house. And I got on my knees and I told God, I'm going to stay here until I get an answer. And I began to pray. And I made God a promise. I said, I will never do that to another woman as long as I live. More importantly, I won't do that to me. I will live a celibate life, and I will work with newcomers, and I will do one thing, and that is seek to be of more service to you and to my fellows. And that night, I met the woman who was to become my wife. That night. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, Tom, you're married. You're really married. I used to kid him. I'd say, you're even married when you're out of town. And I said, would you teach me how to do that? And he said, I will, but you have to do what I tell you. And I did. And over 40 years of age, my sponsor taught me how to date. My first impulse was to jump into a permanent, committed relationship. And he said, you're not ready for that. And I said, but I think I am. I don't want to be with anybody else. He said, no. He said, you have a lot of friends who are women. He said, you get along well with women. You go to movies and dinner. So I want you to do that. He said, one day you'll know why. And so I did. About 6 months later, I went to him and I said, you know why? And he said, why? I said, my fear is that if I love someone, if they can choose anybody but me, they will. So what I would do is take them prisoner. And then I would resent the fact that I had done it because I wasn't ready. And then they would end up paying the price for what I had done. I would emotionally or somehow beat them up for agreeing to be in a permanent relationship with me. And he said, now you're ready for an exclusive relationship. So we had an exclusive relationship. And, you know, a year later I said, you know, Tom, I'm gonna get married. He said, well, you can't get married. And I said, why? And he said, you're not engaged. And I said, that's an old idea, Tom. He said, it got to be that way for a reason, Keith. And so I bought a ring and I went and talked to her parents and asked their permission. Her mother was for it. His dad was dubious. No, I'm just kidding. And then Christmas Eve, I built a fire in the fireplace, and she'd come over, and we were going to go to midnight mass together. I was going to get on one knee and to ask her. Just as I was going to do that, she got up to go in the bathroom. And, you know, once an alcoholic gets started, and so I chased her in the bathroom. And I put the ring on the wrong finger of the wrong hand and asked her, she would be my wife, and she fell in my arms and cried, and I cried, and we went off to Mass, and we looked at each other and cried all through Mass. It was wonderful. So for a year and a half, I was engaged, and being engaged meant that my life was her business, and I would do silly things, like I'd get my calendar and say, honey, these are the commitments I have to conferences and things. Is there anything you want to do? Because let's get it in now before somebody calls. And I would tell her where I would be and when I would be there and when I would see her. My life became her business. And when I was married before, my life wasn't my wife's business. Well, I didn't want her to know what I was doing. That's why I wasn't. And then the day came, and I said to my sponsor, I said, Julia's going to move in with me because we're going to be getting married in a few months, and she can transfer her job. He said, no. He said, that's a violation of your principles. And he said, more importantly, he said, you're an active, fairly long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you live in a community where people know you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you owe it to AA to walk with dignity. And he said, living with a woman you're not married to is not walking with dignity. And so we didn't move in together. And then one day, May the 20th, I don't forget that. May the 20th, 11 years ago this year, I married my wife and I carried her across the threshold. And then I knew why it was so important to do this properly, because that was the foundation upon which I hope to spend the rest of my life. Because I want you to know that even knowing what is right, I won't do it on my own. Fear and instinct takes over, and I end up doing things that violate the principles upon which I want to live my life. And that's why, with 27 years of sobriety next month, I am as actively involved with my sponsor as I've ever been. I want to talk just for a minute about some of the guys I sponsor. Okay? I sponsor a bunch of guys. I sponsor six guys in prison. And if you don't go into institutions, please, if you want a full life, if you want the riches that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, get involved with new people and get involved with service work. I love prisons. I'm never happier than when I'm in a prison. And I mean that. I mean, I come alive. I love those guys. I sponsor two guys. One guy will never get out, but two of these guys I'm sponsoring. One is getting out in less than a month, and he's been in for 30 years. And it's magnificent being around him as we talk about the microwave and the VCR and all that stuff. And it's like, I'm just thrilled to be a part of that. There's another man who hated his father and never spoke to his father and refused anything his father ever had to do. And he's been in for 30 years. He went in when he was 14. He's 44 years old. He's never been out. And we worked these steps. And he's 8 years sober now. And he's as fine a member of Alcoholics Anonymous as I've ever met anywhere, in or outside of the walls. And he wrote a letter of amends to his sister and asked her to send his father's phone number. And we called his father. And he talked to his father. And he told him he was so very sorry that he would never have anything to do with him. And his father began to cry. The man's 80-some years old. And he said, I have a picture from you from the newspaper when you played ball. And it sits right next to my chair. And every day I ask God to bless you and to forgive me for not being there. You don't want to miss this. You don't want to miss this. A guy who's never had a father has a father. You just don't want to miss this. Alcoholics Anonymous offers a program for living. It's a plan for living. It's called the 12 steps and 12 traditions, 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't take advantage of this, it's like being at a sumptuous feast and starving to death. This is the best there is anywhere. The best there is anywhere. I've studied a lot. I've studied a lot of different religious traditions and everything else. I love the church in which I grew up in. I just love it more every day. But I wouldn't give anything for this. I don't expect to get what I get here or there. There's no place in the world I can be of service like I'm of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm made for this. And somebody said to me, do you ever get to spend any weekends home? The answer is not many. But you know, I get tired sometimes. And of course you get tired. You get tired doing your service work too. But you know, the bottom line is this. I owe Alcoholics Anonymous everything. I owe you so much that I can't even pay the interest on the principal. And the longer I'm alive, the richer I get, the further in debt I get to you. Alcoholics Anonymous has it all, if we'll take advantage of it. You know, if you're kind of new, find a sponsor who's actively involved in the lives of other people. He doesn't have to be liked. If he's actively involved, he probably won't be. Okay? And become a man or woman of service, and you'll truly know what love is all about. I'm delighted to have spent this time with you. It's been a little bit chaotic, but we're tough. I mean, heck, at some of the bars and places we drank in, this is nothing. I really am grateful to have been asked to be part of this. I want to thank the other speakers. My friend Ken D is speaking tonight. He's wonderful. He's just a great guy. And Bernie tomorrow, you're really going to enjoy Bernie. I was with Bernie out in Fresno a couple of weeks ago, and Bernie got sober in the Fresno area, so it was especially gratifying to be home with Bernie and his wife Madonna. But most of all, I'm grateful to you, the people who would come here on Saturday afternoon without a football game and listen to me. Thank you very much.